Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure and an honor to welcome you to the first of what will now be an Ernest Gellner memorial lecture dealing with nationalism. I do so with very mixed emotions. His death in November was very tragic, tremendous shock, an enormous loss to us. I feel, however, he's right behind me. We're going to have to be fairly careful what we say. His presence is still here. And before introducing Anthony Smith, I'd like to say a couple of things about why I think it's very appropriate that this memorial lecture is going to be held at LSE. This is where Ernest did most of his great work on nationalism. Most of his scholarly career was spent here. Most important thing I'd like to say is that his work on nationalism is going to last for sure, because there's a sense in which his life inextricably involved him in that particular subject. Prague has been the city which produced the great theorists of nationalism, from Cohn to Gellner to Lemberg to Hrock, and Gellner's own background partly explains some of the circumstances that made that so. His family was German-speaking, of Jewish origin. It came to Prague at the end of the 19th century. After the First World War, he himself grew up in a genuinely bilingual family, Czech and German. He knew what it was like to live in a city with conflict in it. He once, when he was at school, volunteered to sing a song, a Czech song, with different words, German words, and did so to the horror of his classmates, never made the same mistake again. Nevertheless, he and his family were very loyal to Masaryk's Republic, a republic which has certain sympathy for Jews. It explains the fact that they stayed in Prague really astonishingly late. After the German occupation of 1939, they were there, escaped terribly, terribly late, and very luckily, especially in the father's case. But Ernest himself returned having known that some of his family had been killed in concentration camps in 1945, still with great nostalgia for Prague, but a nostalgia which was very rapidly removed, because he returned to witness the sort of ethnic cleansing of the Sudeten population, something he could understand, but nevertheless found repulsive. He used to buy houses to the horror of his wife, and we're very happy to have here today, all over the place, but he could never quite bring himself to buy one in Bohemia. So he didn't actually really quite belong anywhere. He had a Central European past made up of these different elements. He left in 1945. He was convinced that the Czechs would side relatively willingly with the Russians for fear that having expelled the Germans might want some revenge. He was torn apart by these things, came to the LSE, thought about nationalism, both in his philosophy as well as in his sociology. But in 1989, immediately answered a call to return to the Czech lands, and in a certain sense, I think in the last years of his life, exhausted himself trying to change Czech lands in some particular way. He found the rather homogenous, claustrophile world of modern Czech lands, a world without Germans or Jews, in a certain sense very depressing, provincial, and he was desperately trying to establish intellectual links to the Czech community to make more and more sort of connections to the external world, to open it up, to liberalize the system as much as he possibly could, and exhausted himself in the process. The point that I'd like to make about Ernest as a result of those comments is that he was torn in his mind in a hugely honorable way when thinking about nationalism. On the one hand, he had a deep understanding and, in a certain sense, sympathy for it. His theory of nationalism is often held to be purely instrumental, but it's not really. He could feel the power of nationalism. I have sat inside a very small car with him when he took out his mouth organ and played Czech folk songs in a sort of a lamentably schmaltzy way, and he knew hundreds of them. It went on for a very long time. He really could feel nationalism, the need for belonging. He understood that. He understood what it, how much people's identities were involved in it, and yet he knew that at certain moments it could be repulsive. To maintain an ambiguity is the sign of a very great mind indeed. His theories will always be with us because he was able to encompass wobbling a little bit back and forth at any particular time, realizing that the Austrian Empire was doomed to collapse, lamenting the fact that the Russian Empire collapsed so very fast. But his work will stay with us precisely because it manages to contain both these extremes. Well, it's absolutely true. You shouldn't stand too long before the main business. Main business is Anthony Smith. Ernest would always introduce him by saying, I was at LSE for 30 years. If ever asked to explain what I was doing, it was educating Anthony Smith, who occupies the largest place in any bibliography of nationalism. I think it's appropriate also to congratulate him for his organization, the Association for Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism. When Anthony has a good cause between his teeth, he becomes a force of nature, and Assen is known certainly throughout Eastern Europe and in other parts of the world, and it's a very great credit to him as its president. So without further ado, the first Gellner Memorial Lecture on Nationalism.
Thank you very much, John. Yes, kind introduction. This is a sad and a strange occasion. I've been asked to stand in the place where my teacher, Ernest Gellner, was to have stood today, and to continue an unfinished dialogue which we've been conducting for most of our scholarly lives. I've been asked to speak to you about Ernest's theory of nationalism, the great issue of the modern world with which he grappled all his life, as you've heard, and to which he made so unique and profound a contribution. Though I'd heard Ernest's lecture in 1964 and 1965 here, it was only when he agreed to supervise my PhD thesis in 1966 that I came into close contact with him on a regular basis. Since that time, Ernest has been in my thoughts as teacher and scholar, and also as the pioneer of the sociological study of our common interest, our passionate interest, in nationalism. And in our last meetings here and at Warwick, both of us shared the hope of seeing a sister institute dedicated to the study of nationalism being created here at LSE, similar to that which Ernest directed at the Central European University in Prague. Though I'd read Words and Things at Oxford, my first real encounter with Ernest's thought was with his second book, Thought and Change, especially the chapter on nationalism. It was a chapter that largely set the terms of subsequent debate in this field. From this encounter, from my subsequent work under his supervision, I took away four fundamental lessons in the study of nationalism. The first was the centrality of nationalism for an understanding of the modern world. The fact that Ernest took up the issues of nationalism in the 1960s, that he kept returning to them when most social scientists were interested in Marxism, functionalism, phenomenology, indeed everything but nationalism, the fact that he established a center for the study of nationalism in Prague devoted to research and latterly to teaching in this field demonstrates how thoroughly he appreciated the power, the ubiquity, and the durability of nationalism. The second lesson that I learnt from Ernest was the need to appreciate the sheer complexity, the protean elusiveness, of the phenomena that are gathered together under the rubric of nationalism. And that's why he insisted on comparative analysis and on the need to formulate typologies that do justice to the complexities of nationalism. A third lesson was the sociological reality of nations and nationalism. Unlike many latter-day scholars for whom the nation is a cultural artifact and nationalism a discourse, Ernest insisted on the structural embeddedness of nations and nationalism. hence the need, as he saw it, to use sociological concepts and methods to provide an understanding of this most complex of phenomena. This meant, of course, jettisoning nationalism's own accounts of itself as an awakening of the slumbering but primordial nation through the kiss of nationalist Prince Charming's, and instead grasping nationalism as the necessary outcome of a particular kind of social structure and culture. The final lesson was the hardest, the one on which I have stumbled most. Nations as well as nationalism, Ernest argued, are wholly modern. That's to say, they're not only recent, dating from the period of the French Revolution or a bit earlier, they're also novel, the products of modernity, that whole nexus of processes that went into the making of the West over the last four centuries, including capitalism, industrialism, urbanization, the bureaucratic state, and secularization. It was this final lesson that was at issue in our last encounter at Warwick, when, at the invitation of Edward Mortimer and the university, Ernest and I debated the origins and functions of nationalism. That debate, just 12 days before his tragically early death, was entitled The Nation, Real or Imagined. But since we both agreed that nations, like buildings or works of art, are created, albeit over generations, and are therefore both real and imagined, the question became the different, but perhaps more important one, of the relationship between nations and their putative pasts. It is, after all, difficult to see how a purely cultural artifact could inspire the loyalty and self-sacrifice of countless people. On the other hand, the primordialist picture of natural nations, of nations inscribed in the natural order, was equally unacceptable. So the question then became, where do nations come from? Or in Ernest's words, do nations have navels? This question was the title that Ernest gave me for today's Nations and Nationalism lecture as we stood on the platform in Coventry after the Warwick debate. Hence my problem and my title, Memory and Modernity. Fortunately, Warwick University kindly supplied me with a transcript of Ernest's reply to my opening statement in that debate. Let me quote the bit about national navels on which he hoped to elaborate. Speaking of the dividing line between modernists and primordialists, Ernest asked for the kind of evidence that would decide whether nations had pasts that matter, or whether the world and nations with them was created about the end of the 18th century, and nothing, I quote, before that makes the slightest difference to the issues we face. Was mankind, he asked, the creator of Adam, and did it slowly evolve? The evidence that was debated at the time this issue was alive revolved around the question, and here I quote at length from the transcript, did Adam have or did he not have a navel? Now it's a very crucial question, you see. No, you may fall about laughing, but obviously if Adam was created by God at a certain date, let's say 4003 BC, obviously, I mean, it's a prima facie first reaction that he didn't have a navel, so to say, because Adam did not go through the process by which people acquire navels. Therefore, we do know what will decide whether the world is very old and mankind evolved, or whether the world was created about 6,000 years ago. Namely, all we need to know is whether Adam had a navel or not. The question I'm going to address myself to, of course, is do nations have navels, or do they not? My main case for modernism, he continued, that I'm trying to highlight in this debate is that, on the whole, the ethnic, the cultural, national community, which is such an important part of Antony's case, is rather like the navel. Some nations have it and some don't, and in any case it's inessential. What, in a way, Antony is saying is that he is anti-creationist, and we have this plethora of navels, and they are essential, as he said, and this, I think, is the crux of the case between him and me. In my opening statement at Warwick, I had argued that the modernist standpoint, which Ernest embraced, the idea that nations are products of modernization and couldn't have existed before the advent of modernity, told only half the story. Well, if it tells half the story, Ernest quipped, that's good for me, because it means that the additional bits of the story in the other half are redundant. He may not have meant it that way, but if the modernist theory accounts for half, or 60%, or 40%, or 30% of the nations, this is good for me. Well, as Ernest knew, I didn't mean it that way. But from his standpoint, it would actually suffice if there were just one case of a nation being accounted for by modernism to be true. And he produced his case. The Estonians. This is what he had to say about them. At the beginning of the 19th century, they didn't even have a name for themselves. They were just referred to as people who lived on the land, as opposed to German or Swedish burghers and aristocrats and Russian administrators. They had no ethnonym. They were just a category without any ethnic self-consciousness. Since then, they've been brilliantly successful in creating a vibrant culture. And he went on to praise this very vital and vibrant culture, which is so vividly displayed in the Ethnographic Museum in Tartu, with its 100,000 objects, one for every 10 Estonians, claiming that it was created by, I quote, the kind of modernist process which I then generalized for nations and nationalism in general. And Ernest returned to the Estonians at the end of his opening statement when he tried to list the factors that may help us to predict which potential nations or cultural categories will assert themselves. A question which I had posed in my opening statement. I quote, "Now, obviously, it does matter to predict which nations will assert themselves, which potential nations, which cultural categories will assert themselves and which will not. I would say it is inherent in the situation that you cannot tell. You can indicate certain factors. Size is an obvious one. Very small cultural groups give up. Continuity is another one, but not an essential one. Some diasporic communities have very effectively asserted themselves. Size, continuity, existence of symbolism are all important. But again, the Estonians created nationalism ex nihilo in the course of the 19th century. I could quibble here and say that the issue was not whether the Estonians created nationalism ex nihilo in the 19th century, but whether the Estonian nation was created by the Estonian nationalists ex nihilo. And while we would both agree that Estonian nationalism, indeed any nationalism, was modern, where Ernest and I would differ is whether the nations that nationalism creates are wholly modern creations ex nihilo. Ernest returned to this question when he disagreed with my reading of the classical legacy of modern Greece, but admitted that, and I quote, "There's some continuity with Byzantium, or generate with the clerical organization left behind by Byzantium, certainly. But sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't, continuity. So I would say in general that there is a certain amount of naval about, but not everywhere, and on the whole, it's not important. It's not like the cycles of respiration, blood circulation, or food digestion, which Adam would have had to have in order to live at the moment of creation." Now here lies the rub. If we pursue the analogy, we recall that God created Adam, fashioning his body and then breathing life into it. Not even the most megalomaniac nationalists has claimed quite that power. They have, of course, seen themselves as awakeners. But the body of the nation merely slumbered. It was not without life. Should we confer on nationalists that divine power to create ex nihilo? Of course, Ernest wants to confer that power through nationalism ultimately on modernity, on the growth society, on industrialism and its cultural prerequisites. For Ernest, the genealogy of the nation is located in the requirements of modernity, not the heritage of pre-modern past. Ernest is claiming that nations have no parents, no pedigree except the needs of modern society. Those needs can only be met by a mass, public, literate, specialized culture, a high culture, preferably in a specific language which allows context-free communication. A high culture is the only cement for a modern, mobile, industrial society, and this is the only kind of society open to us today. For Ernest, the world was irreversibly transformed by a cluster of economic and scientific changes since the 17th century. Traditional agro-literate societies, as he called them, were increasingly replaced by growth-oriented, mobile, industrial societies. The rise of high cultures and nations is a consequence of the mobility and anonymity of modern society and of the semantic, non-physical nature of modern work. Today, what really matters is not kingship or land or faith, but education into and membership of a high culture community, that is, a nation. So, just as Pallas Athene sprang fully armed from the head of Zeus without parents, so nations emerge fully fledged from the requirements of modernity. If nations did have navels, they were purely ornamental. But can we derive nations tout court from the needs of modernity? To be fair, it isn't modernity that directly creates nations. To quote Ernest's original formulation in 1964, nationalism invents nations where they do not exist. But it does need some pre-existing differentiating marks to work on, even if these are purely negative. The same sequence is restated in his later book in 1983. It is nationalism which engenders nations and not the other way round. Admittedly, he continued, nationalism uses the pre-existing, historically inherited proliferation of cultures or cultural wealth, though it uses them very selectively and it most often transforms them very radically. Dead languages can be revived, traditions invented, quite fictitious pristine purities restored. But this culturally creative, fanciful, positively inventive aspect of nationalist ardour ought not to allow anyone to conclude erroneously that nationalism is a contingent, artificial, ideological invention. This is a crucial passage, but it is by no means an isolated one. Throughout his writings on nationalism, Ernest keeps returning to the idea that nationalisms frequently make use of the past, albeit very selectively. This reveals an ambivalence at the heart of his theory, one highlighted by the word admittedly in the passage I have just quoted. Admittedly, nationalism uses the pre-existing, historically inherited proliferation of cultures. It's this ambivalence that I want to explore, because here, I believe, lies the main limitation of all modernist theories of nationalism, including Ernest. I want to examine this ambivalence under three headings: the parentage or genealogy of nations, the question of cultural continuity and transformation, and the role of collective memory. As far as the genealogy of nations is concerned, Ernest is saying two things. Nations are navel-less, they don't have parents, and even if they did, it's irrelevant. Nations begin de novo in a brave new industrial world. One might start by asking which of these positions Ernest really claims. If some nations had navels, they had ancestors. We could then try to compare the navel-less, ancestor-less nations with the nations that had navels and ancestors to see how each class of nations was faring. That's an interesting empirical question. But if having ancestors is a priori irrelevant, then why should even some nationalists make use of their past? Note, it is not any past. For my nation, your past will not do. It has to be my past, or past, or more usually some of my past. But why return to the past at all? If the past is irrelevant to the needs of a modern society, then why does any nationalism bother to return to some sort of past? Is this just a delusion, a matter of false consciousness? That's a position Ernest would, I believe, strongly deny, but he doesn't really explore the issue. The other answer that's often given to this question is that elites, or people in general, have to return to tradition and ancestry to legitimate the new type of industrial capitalist society and control the changes it must undergo. But that only begs the question as to why elites or people in general feel the need to refer back to their ancestral traditions. Can it be because these traditions are still quite powerful, and many people still operate in terms of these traditions, however irrelevant they may seem to some elites and to the theorist of modernity? In other words, many people appear not only to believe they have navels, they believe in the reality of the situation which gave them navels and which their navels symbolize. In short, they believe they have collective parents, and these parents are important ways relevant to their present situation. This belief is not entirely unfounded. Historically, the members of a community can point to a considerable amount of evidence to support their belief in the genealogy of nations. They can refer to documents and artifacts which bear out the belief that many present-day industrial or industrializing societies, from England and France to Russia and Poland, from Japan and Korea to America and Mexico, are closely related to, indeed, grew out of past communities with which they identify. Members can point to the fact that, despite the many transformations they've undergone, their nations continue to share with past communities such features as a proper name, a rough territory, a language, some artistic styles, sets of myths and symbols, traditions of heroes and heroines, memories of golden ages, and the like. In other words, they conceive of their nation, despite all these changes, as stemming from older communities of historic culture with whom they share myths of descent and common memories, including links with the homeland. We don't have to accept the ideology of nationalism itself, with its romantic belief in the awakening of the nation, its mission and destiny, to realize that we cannot fully grasp the rise and character of so many modern nations unless we explore their historical antecedents and the continuing influence of those antecedents in the modern epoch. Earnest modernism tells us how a nation, modern nation operates, indeed must operate, in the modern industrial age. But it cannot tell us which nations will emerge, where, and why these nations rather than others. To return to an example which Earnest used in the Warwick debate, modern Israel, he argued, is furnished with all the cultural equipment needed in the modern world. A literate, mass, public education system, a common modernized language, a modern system of communications and legal system, in short, a high culture of the kind required by the mobile anonymous society which industrialism creates. In a state like Israel, where immigrants from over 70 lands and many cultures have been ingathered, this sort of standardized, public, unifying high culture is all the more necessary. To cope with the challenges of modernity, which is what any society must do if it is to survive today, you require a high culture. In the modern world, the culture and religion of the past is at best irrelevant, at worst an impediment. But equally, in my view, this same example demonstrates that we cannot hope to explain the rise and character of modern nations solely in terms of the requirements of modernity. Even that arch-modernist Theodor Herzl conceived of Israel as a haven for an ancient diaspora people, a Judenstaat, a state of and for unassimilable Jews, taking up where the last independent Jewish state, the Hasmonean state, had left off, in Zion. It was this ultimately religious and political vision, rather than the needs of modernity, that inspired and mobilized many diaspora Jews to become Zionists and take the arduous road to Palestine. And it was a vision that assumed a genealogy and an ancient pedigree and a name for a nation to be, one that addressed, as does every nationalism, a designated and particular people. To assert, with another modernist, Eric Hobsbawm, that there's simply no connection between the age-old Jewish yearnings and pilgrimages to Zion and the modern ingathering of Jewish exiles into Palestine is to miss not only the element of ethnic ascription, but also the whole aspect of popular motivation and collective self-understanding, which is essential to the success of any nationalism. That's what I meant when I argued that modernism can tell us only half the story. It tells us in general why there have to be nations and nationalism in the modern world. It does not tell us what those nations will be, or where they will emerge, or why so many people are prepared to die for them. Nor does it tell us much about the character of particular nationalisms, whom they address, and whether they are religious or secular, conservative or radical, civic or ethnic, issues that are vital both for the participants and their victims, and for a scholarly understanding of nations and nationalism. I'm suggesting, then, that to understand modern nations and nationalism, we have to explore not only the processes and requirements of modernity, but also the genealogies of nations. In fact, we have to explore the impact of the processes of modernization on those genealogies, and the way in which they've given rise to selections and transformations by each generation of pre-existing ethnic ties and of the ethnic traditions they have inherited. Now, we may admit that in the case of the nations I've cited, it makes sense to explore their genealogies. But what of modern nations that have lost their parents, or never had them, or are not quite sure who their parents were? This poses considerable problems for nationalists attempting to create nations. It's certainly one reason for the enormous popularity of the epics, the Kalevala with the Finns, and the Kalevipoeg with the Estonians. Yes, the Estonians did have a navel after all. As a leading historian of Estonia, Toivo Raun, writing of the Estonian national revival of the 1860s, put it, among the Estonian population, the importance of Kalevipoeg was not so much literary, it took decades to reach a wide audience, as it was symbolic, affirming the historical existence of the Estonian nation. Both these epics traced the descent of the Finns and the Estonians to Iron Age culture communities, and thereby provided these dispossessed and subject peoples with a sense of their dignity through native ancestry and an ancient and heroic ethnic past. In this way, they confirmed the worldwide belief in the virtues of national genealogies. To dismiss this by attributing it to the ubiquitous influence of nationalism again begs the question of why so many people have been mobilized on the basis of this particular belief in the genealogy of nations. Besides, nationalists have usually managed to find some historical antecedents for their nations to be, albeit often embellished and exaggerated. And this suggests that there are mechanisms at work which ensure some connection and even continuity between the modern nation and one or more pasts. To two of these mechanisms, I now turn. The first lies in the field of culture, and it provides us with a second focus for exploring the ambivalence in Ernest and other versions of modernism. For Ernest, modernity introduces a radical cultural break. This has two aspects. The first is underlined in the theorem which underpins his early formulation of modernism. That theorem states that in pre-modern societies, culture reinforces structure, whereas in modern societies, culture replaces structure. By this, Ernest meant that kinship roles organize social life in simple traditional societies, and symbols, myths, traditions, and customs reinforced and expressed that kinship structure. Modern society, with the possible exception of bureaucracy, has no such structure. Instead, it has a common culture. In the polyglot, anonymous city where most encounters are ephemeral, people can only relate to each other through context-free communication. This requires a common culture in preferably a common language. The precondition of membership in such a society and of citizenship in the state is literacy. Today, by necessity, we are all clerks. In a later article, and in his Nations and Nationalism, Ernest focused more upon the changed nature of work and the generic training required for a mobile industrial society. To train a mobile workforce and citizenry to master the techniques of semantic work, modern societies require a new kind of education system. For this, Ernest coined the term exosocialization. In the old agro-literate society, rote learning at one's mother's knee or in the village school sufficed. In a modern industrializing or industrial society, external, state-imposed, standardized mass schooling was needed to create the literate and technically sophisticated workforce necessary to man the industrial machine. And the teachers, too, had to be specialized educational personnel, able to service the new literate high culture which characterizes and defines modern nations. This concept of a high culture became the key to Ernest's later theory of nationalism. In an interesting section of Nations and Nationalism, Ernest contrasts the high culture of modern societies with the low cultures of agro-literate societies. A high culture, as we've seen, is a literate, sophisticated culture, serviced by specialized educational personnel and taught formally in mass, public, standardized, and academy-supervised institutions of learning. It's a highly cultivated, or garden, culture. A low culture, by contrast, is wild, spontaneous, undirected, and unsupervised. These are the cultures that readily spring up, unbidden, in societies where the great mass of the population are food producers, servicing the needs of tiny, specialized elites, clerices, aristocracies, merchants, and the like, who are almost completely cut off socially and culturally from the peasant masses. In such a society, there's neither need nor room for nations and nationalism, since the many low cultures of the peasants are local and almost invisible. Thus, in agro-literate societies, in Ernest's words, culture tends to be branded either horizontally by social caste or vertically to define very small communities. Now, for Ernest, all these low cultures are doomed. They are cut off like so many umbilical cords because they're simply irrelevant in an impersonal, mobile, modern society. If they're remembered at all, it is only through some symbols in the same way that navels remind us of our origins. Nationalism, Ernest claims, is basically a product of modernity. Nationalism is, he says, essentially, I quote, the general imposition of a high culture on society where previously low cultures had taken up the lives of the majority, and in some cases the totality of the population. Nationalism is the establishment of an anonymous, impersonal society with mutually substitutable atomized individuals, held together above all by a shared culture of this kind, in place of a previous complex structure of local groups sustained by folk cultures reproduced locally and idiosyncratically by the microgroups themselves. That is what really happens. Nothing could be clearer. The many old low cultures vanish. They are replaced by a single new high culture or nation. This is the true meaning of nationalism. But there are two problems here, of which Ernest was well aware. Some low cultures are not severed. Instead, they become high cultures. The Finns and the Estonians clearly fall into this category, as do many of the cultures of the other smaller subject peoples of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. The other problem is that certain old elite cultures become high cultures. The literary cultures of the Armenians, the Greeks, and the Jews clearly fall under this heading, as do several of the cultures of Western people, like the Catalans, the English, and the French. Awareness of the difficulties posed for modernism by both these problems is an important source of its ambivalence. How do low cultures become high cultures? Why does Estonian win out over German, Swedish, and Russian cultures in Estonia, and Finnish over Swedish and Russian cultures in Finland? Both these cultures were local, popular, largely confined to the peasants, at least at first. Why do these Ruritanians become conscious of their local folk cultures and seek to turn what were low cultures into high cultures for the nation to be? Or were they really such low cultures? And is the contrast between low and high cultures as sharp as Ernest alleges? In the case of Estonia, we know of Estonian language religious texts during the Reformation. And certainly by the 17th century, with the establishment of the University of Tartu and later Forselius's school system, the basis of a literate Estonian culture emerged a century and a half before the arrival of the Romantic movement in the Baltic states in the mid-19th century. True, Germans and Swedes made the running, but a native Estonian poem of 1708, lamenting the miseries of the great northern war between Peter the Great and the Swedes, fought over Estonian lands, reveals a growing Estonian consciousness. Moreover, written Estonian can even be found in the 13th century chronicle of Henry of Livonia, recording the German conquest of Estonia in the face of much resistance. All this suggests that the transition to an Estonian high culture was much more gradual and long drawn out than a modernist account would suggest. If this is the case with a so-called low culture, such as the Estonian, it's likely to prove even more true of old, literate, specialist supported, and therefore, in a sense, high cultures like those of the French, the Arabs, the Jews, and the Greeks. True, the languages and cultures of these peoples had to be modernized to cope with modern conditions. They had to be simplified, standardized, secularized, and expanded to cover all sorts of undreamt of phenomena and novel concepts, and embrace all classes and regions of the nation to be. But the old high caste literate cultures were not scrapped and replaced. They were adapted, purified, enlarged, and diffused, often through self-conscious cultural reformist movements. Sometimes, as in modern Greece, this involved a measure of compromise with its pasts, between a popular Byzantine Orthodox heritage and a classicizing Athenian language and culture. In this case, the recovery of ancient Greek texts and sculptures did create considerable preoccupation with Periclean Athens among the Greek-speaking intelligentsia, but it had constantly to compete with the more popular memories of Byzantium carried by an Orthodox liturgy and congregation. What I'm arguing here is that most modern languages and cultures are not invented. They are connected to, and often continuous with, much older cultures which the modernizing nationalists adapt and standardized. By Ernest's criterion, many of these older languages and cultures were, indeed, high cultures. But even when they were low or lower, spontaneous, popular cultures, they could become the basis for a subsequent high culture. Ernest hints at this when he speaks of Ruritanians in the metropolis of megalomania, who, faced with the problems of labor migration and bureaucracy, soon come to understand the difference between dealing with a co-national, I quote, one understanding and sympathizing with their culture and someone hostile to it. This very concrete experience taught them to be aware of their culture and love it, or indeed to wish to be rid of it. In other words, it's the old, low culture to which they cling, or not, as the case may be. And it's the old, low culture which, far from being cut off and thrown away, will soon become the modern, high, taught culture, albeit for several hundred thousands or millions of people. There are many examples of this cultural connectedness and continuity amid change, and we need to remind ourselves that cultural continuity is not the same as cultural fixity. Take the realm of language development. The English and French languages evolved over many centuries, with several admixtures of other languages, yet we can trace lines of development which reveal their underlying continuity. Alternatively, there's a conscious reform of language and culture, as occurred with the Turkic languages under the impulse of the Jadid educational movement of Ismail Bey Gasprinsky, or with Hebrew through the modernizing reforms of Eliezer ben Yehuda. In the latter case, the differences between biblical and modern Hebrew are considerable, yet modern Hebrew is clearly based on and developed from biblical Hebrew. In terms of names, territorial attachments, and myths of origin, too, there are striking connections and continuities, despite changes of cultural contents over time. This is especially true of island cultures like Japan, with its relative continuity of territory, identity, and origin myths. But it can also be found in mixed cultures, like those of Mexico, whose modern cultural nationalists have sought to recover and reappropriate some aspects of the pre-Columbian, mainly Aztec, past. Of course, it can be argued that the very need to recover the past is evidence for discontinuity. There certainly had been discontinuity, especially after Hernan Cortes' invasion. But among the many indigenous ethnies of Mexico, the old cultures still live in varying degrees and guises to be used as partial models and disseminated through the mass public education system to the mestizo majority. This leads us directly to the final focus of modernist ambivalence, namely the part played by collective memory in the formation of nations. Collective memories form another major link with an ethnic past or past. Ernest was very conscious of the role of memory in creating nations, if only because, like Renan, he emphasized the importance of national amnesia and getting one's history wrong for the maintenance of national solidarity. But there was no systematic attempt in his work to deal with the problems posed by shared memories of a collective past. For Renan, memories were constitutive of the nation. The nation is built on shared memories of joy and suffering, and above all, of collective sacrifices. Hence the importance of battles, defeats, no less than victories, for mobilizing and unifying ethnies and nations, all too evident in such sensitive areas of national conflict as Bosnia and Palestine. Memory, of course, can be easily manipulated. Witness the sudden surge of feeling over the mosque built on the Temple of Ram at Ayodhya in India, or the post-war Israeli cult of Masada, a formerly obscure episode and half-forgotten fortress on the Dead Sea. Besides, we need to distinguish between genuine folk memories and the more official, documented or excavated records of an often heroic past. Despite these caveats, shared historical memories play a vital role in modern nationalism. The question is, how far can the modernist theory of nationalism accommodate them? There are, I think, two problems here. The first is that the nation which modernist theories of nationalism conceive as the object of explanation is divested of identity. It's either conflated with a state to become the nation state, or it is equated, as in Ernest's theory, with a modern high culture to become a more or less stable configuration of objective traits like language and customs in a large, anonymous, unmediated, and co-cultural unit. Now, the nation does indeed have some objective attributes, like a name, a demarcated territory, even a common economy. But equally important are its more subjective properties, such as a fund of distinctive myths and memories, as well as elements of a common mass culture. This means that we must take into account the perceptions, the sentiments, and the activities of its members in the definition of national identity. The cultivation of shared memories constitutes a vital element constitutes a vital element in of a mass a common mass culture. The second reason why modernist theories give little space to the role of collective memories is their tendency to rely on purely structural explanations. With the exception of Benedict Anderson's analysis of the representation of nationalist images, most modernists trace the origins, rise, and course of nations and nationalism to the consequences of uneven capitalism, industrialism, militarism, the bureaucratic state, or class conflicts, or combinations of these. Where the role of ideas is also admitted, the origins of nationalism are ascribed to the influence of secularism, the Enlightenment, and sometimes Romanticism. Only in this last movement is there any room for a consideration of the role of collective memory. But Romanticism is usually treated, if at all, as a secondary, even residual, explanatory factor. I think we can overcome these limitations and build into Ernest's framework a fuller account of the role of shared memories if we marry his insistence that nationalisms create nations to the ethno-symbolic resources that they must use if they are to succeed. Take the vistas opened up by the emerging disciplines of archaeology and history. The excavations of Great Zimbabwe with its elliptical temple, of Teotihuacan on the central Mexican plateau, and of the tomb of Tutankhamun in Egypt, created no continuity between the modern Zimbabwe, Mexico, and Egypt, and their presumed ancient or medieval ethnic past. What they did was to suggest, in some cases establish, connections with distant and glorious periods, or golden ages, of communal history, thereby extending the collective self-imaginings and shared memories of their members back in time through a reconstructed past, and conferring a sense of dignity and authenticity on their citizens. It is modern citizens who need and reconstruct an heroic ethnic past. But once reconstructed, that past exerts its own power of definition through ancestry and shared, albeit taught, memory. The territorialization of memory provides another example of the power of shared rememberings. By this I mean the ways in which shared memories become attached to particular terrains and over time forge delimited homelands. The term homeland suggests an ancestral territory, one which has become communalized through shared memories of collective experiences. The ancestral land is the place where, in the shared memories of its inhabitants, the great events that formed the nation took place, the place where the heroes, saints, and sages of the community from which the nation later developed, lived and worked, and the place where the forefathers and mothers are buried. This last element is particularly important. It ties each family to the homeland through memories of the last resting places of their ancestors, and it sanctifies the homeland by creating its sacred sites and popular pilgrimages. Memory, then, is bound to place, a special place, a homeland. It is also crucial to identity. In fact, one might almost say, no memory, no identity. No identity, no nation. That is why nationalists must rediscover and appropriate shared memories of the past. Identification with the past is the key to creating the nation, because only by remembering the past can a collective identity come into being. The very act of remembering together, of commemorating some event or hero, creates a bond between citizens whose self-interest often brings them into conflict. Hence the constant need to reawaken public memories, to engage in commemorative rites and remembrance ceremonies, especially for those who gave their lives for the community, and to tie those memories to the homeland through daily routines and what Michael Billig in a recent book has called flagging. Collective memories, then, are active components in the creation and reproduction of nations, whether they are familial and unmediated, as often occurs in sub-Saharan Africa, or mediated and public, a construct of elites enacted in rites and ceremonies, and recalled in epics and chronicles, flags and anthems, shared memories are necessary for the formation of nations. States may be established without recourse to memory and remembering, but nations required shared memories to give their often heterogeneous citizenry a common habitat, a source of pride and dignity, and a common destiny. Without them, the subjective element, the sense of being part of a nation, would be absent. There could be no passionate identification by individual citizens with a particular nation, only a generalized, calculating loyalty to the state. We can go further. If the modern nation is in large part a creation of nationalism, as Ernest argued, then there are three vital elements of the nation which, in my view, depend on the role of collective memory. The first is the drive for regeneration, which is based on memories of a golden age or golden ages. This is the idealized former age of great splendor, power and glory, intellectual or artistic creativity or religiosity and sanctity. It's the age of the community's exemplars, its sages and saints, poets and heroes, artists and explorers, the ideal against which to measure the present, usually lamentable, state of the nation, and the spur to emulation for successive generations. The memory of the Golden Age signifies the possibility and hope of national regeneration. A second element is the sense of collective mission and national destiny. There's no nationalism, and few present-day nations, that don't proclaim some special mission and unique destiny. But a sense of collective mission presupposes shared memories of a past or past in which the nation was entrusted with that mission and which shaped a unique community as the vehicle for the development and reproduction of what Max Weber called irreplaceable culture values. Similarly, a sense of national destiny presupposes a well-remembered past, a history of a unique trajectory along which we are destined to travel. Without such memories, without rituals of commemoration, the nation would have no distinctive task or future, and hence no raison d'etre. The third vital component is a sense of national authenticity, and this too is closely bound up with shared memories. What is or what is not mine, what is or what is not distinctive, representative or original, is closely tied to questions of remembering and forgetting. What is inauthentic is in part what is alien to popular consciousness and folk memory. What is original and ours is that which has been hallowed by the shared memories of the people. The acceptance of the Kalevala as Finland's national epic owed much to the survival and resonance among the peasants of the Karelian folk ballads on which Elias Lonnrot based his modern compilation, even if the memories contained in that epic were less than historical. Together, these nationalist concepts of regeneration and the Golden Age, mission and destiny, authenticity and folk culture, all presuppose the influence of shared memories of a collective past, however distorted or dimly remembered. And since it is nationalism that largely creates the modern nation must be built on shared memories of some past or pasts which can mobilize and unite its members. Nihil ex nihilo, nothing comes from nothing. Ernest called himself a creationist, but he attributed the sudden birth of nationalist humanity to a process, the process of modernization, which, like the biblical creation process of 6,000 years ago, was sudden and discontinuous. And modernization keeps bringing nations into being, suddenly, explosively. My view, on the contrary, Ernest termed evolutionist, indeed primordialist. I hope I've made it clear that I in no sense subscribe to any of the forms of primordialism. Nations are modern, as is nationalism, even when their members think they are very old and even when they are in part created out of pre-modern cultures and memories. They've not been there all the time. It is possible that something like modern nations emerged here and there in the ancient and medieval world. That, at least, is an open question requiring more research. But in general, nations are modern. Can my position be called evolutionist in opposition to Ernest's creationism? Not in any strong sense of that term. There's too much discontinuity and change between pre-modern and modern communities to warrant the conclusion that modern nations are the product of slow, gradual, incremental growth from rude beginnings. But in a weaker sense, there is considerable evidence that modern nations are connected with earlier ethnic categories and communities and are created out of pre-existing origin myths, ethnic cultures, and shared memories. And that those nations with a vivid, widespread sense of an ethnic past are likely to be more unified and distinctive than those which lack that sense. It's important to stress here that pre-modern ethnies are not nations, whether in Ernest's definition of the nation or mine. They generally lack a clearly demarcated territory which their members occupy, equal legal rights and duties for all members, and a public mass culture. What they do have, and what they bequeath, albeit selectively, to modern nations, is a fund of myths, symbols, values, and shared memories, some distinctive customs and traditions, a general locations, and sometimes a proper name. Without these shared memories and traditions, myths, and symbols, the basis for creating a nation is tenuous and the task Herculean. Of course, there are exceptions to the rule. Some islands, like Trinidad or Mauritius, emptied of their original inhabitants, may gradually be forged, not without conflict, into unified and distinctive nations through the conscious creation or use of overarching myths and traditions, memories, and symbols. The process of ethnogenesis, after all, goes on all the time, along with and as part of the creation of new nations. The same process may also be taking place in the former Italian province, and now independent state, of Eritrea, with its two religions and nine language groups, with their histories. Nevertheless, these exceptions only go to show that the widely accepted model of the unified and distinctive nation is derived from the many nations with a dominant ethnic past, and that where such a past is lacking, the task of creating a modern nation as opposed to a state is very much harder. This brings me to perhaps the most fundamental difference between my approach and that of Ernest Gellner. For Ernest, it's possible and desirable to have a general theory of nationalism, one that derives from the postulates of modernity. For myself, no such general theory is possible, though I prefer a certain kind of approach which may be termed ethno-symbolist. I feel that the differences between nationalisms across periods and continents are too great to be embraced by a single Euclidean theory. For such a theory can never tell us, as Ernest admitted, which are the nations to be and why they have this or that distinctive character and trajectory. At the same time, such is the force and sweep of Ernest's own theory that nobody, having read it, can fail to be convinced of the centrality and ubiquity of nations and nationalism for the world we live in. Ernest has revealed the sociological foundations of our world of nations and shown us why nationalism must remain a vital and enduring force in the contemporary world. His originality consists in demonstrating why the link between culture and politics is so intrinsic to the modern world and why it must generate so much passion. As a result, Ernest was not among the many who foresaw an early supersession of nations and nationalism, though he was more optimistic about the diminution of its fires in affluent democratic states. This is because he thought that the imperatives of industrialism and mass education would in the end override the power of shared memories of great events and of ancient or recent antagonisms. Of this I am not so sure. The past cannot be swept away so easily. So, to paraphrase Rousseau, nations must have navels, and if they have not got one, we must start by inventing one. And it is because they have navels, and because those navels, and the memories and traditions, myths and symbols they represent, mean so much to the people that have them, that we are so unlikely to see the early transcendence of nations and nationalism.
Well, before asking you to show your appreciation to Anthony for his fine lecture again in a moment, let me say that there's a reception to which you're invited now by the association on the fifth floor of the building. You can take either the stairs or the elevator. But thank you very much indeed, Anthony.